case is 06-1453, Art Welding v. Meyer Products. Mr. Zito, whenever you're ready.
Yes, Your Honor.
You retained 7 minutes for rebuttal?
That's correct.
Only on rebuttal on the issues that are raised by the FRL, correct?
It should be the same issues.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning. Please, the court. I'm Joseph Zito here on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Art Welding. The issues in this case are interrelated, and the primary issue is whether or not a fair and full opportunity was given on the issue of damages by the trial court below. The issue of infringement was properly tried and correct decision. In this case, the plaintiff was the inventor and also made their own product, put their own product in the market. The product of the plaintiff was an aftermarket product. It was added to defendant's product, Meyer's plows. It's an aftermarket product that allowed for automatic raising and lowering. Defendant sold to, through the distributor network, with the approval of plaintiff sold into the defendant's distributor network with the approval of the defendant, with letters from the defendant said it was a nice product. Around 2001, defendant Meyer plows decided to upgrade their controller. And in that process, decided to add automatic raise and lower feature into the controller itself. We believe that the evidence shows that they got this idea because of the aftermarket product plaintiff. Once they added that into their controller, plaintiff's market dried up. You can't sell the aftermarket if the original product already contains this feature.
Mr. Zito, we have a very limited time, so let's get right to the issue of damages. I think the court's aware of all the facts and circumstances of the situation. Where did the court make its error, reversible error in the damages side?
The trial court made a reversible error in not allowing the jury to consider any of these factors, the activities of the parties, in coming to any determination of willfulness. The court took willfulness from the jury on the simple basis that after the defendant was sued, they asked their own internal engineers, do you think we infringe? And the internal engineers said, no, we don't think so. And the trial court said that alone, that one activity alone, is enough to wipe out any inference, any willfulness going to the jury.
Well, the only inference to be drawn, though, I mean, you said, but looking at it from another point, your only evidence is they didn't get an opinion of counsel.
They didn't get an opinion of counsel. The opinion they got from the engineers was not competent.
Did you put on evidence that it wasn't competent?
Yes, we did. And I cite that in brief. The engineers didn't understand the difference between validity and infringement. They came up with a list of factors where the two products were different. They didn't look at the claims. The engineers admitted, one of the engineers came and testified at a deposition at trial that the 8 reasons he came up with in the original letter were all wrong, and he had 2 different reasons which came from trial counsel. So we showed that he didn't know. And the other engineer admitted on the record that he's not a person competent to make that determination. And that's in our brief. Okay? We showed that that was not a competent opinion. What the judge said on granting summary judgment is, well, it doesn't matter if they were right or wrong. The corporation acted reasonably by asking their internal engineers.
Well, the judge granted a motion, 58 motion, on general, right?
Correct.
Indicating there was insufficient evidence to go to the jury.
And we believe that was wrong as a matter of law. Like I said, the evidence of the interaction of the parties, that they got it from our party, that they didn't get a competent opinion, and we elicited testimony at trial from the president who said that he had made knowingly false.
Where's the clear error made by the judge? Because we can only reverse the granting of the 58 motion on a clear error standard.
Well, the clear error is that there is, that you can, lack of a competent opinion is a sufficient basis to find, by the trier of fact, to make a determination of fact as to whether or not the activities were willful. So his clear error of law was not allowing that to go to the fact finder. It was sufficient fact as a clear error of law. We don't have to show to the judge there is willfulness. We merely need to show that there was enough evidence for that willfulness to go to the fact finder.
But the other factor here was the actual knowledge. And the only evidence on natural knowledge was this distribution of brochures, correct?
distribution brochures, the letters from Meyer saying this is, we'll work with the plow, it doesn't void your warranty. The interaction between the inventor, the owner, the plaintiff, and the individuals that, he went to every time they did a seminar, once a year or twice a year, they did a structural seminar for the troopers. He was there with his product, talking to people. They knew about the patent. They knew about the product. That was the evidence of knowledge. And despite that, they also had obviously had knowledge as of the date that the suit was filed. They got the letter for counsel, and they didn't stop manufacturing that product for another 9 months. So at least that period, they definitely had notice. Notice was not a question as of December 2004. Prior to that, there was an issue. It was a factual issue that, again, should have gone to the jury. This also interplays into the testimony issue, the same factual background. We think the plaintiff's president had sufficient background in the industry to testify as to what he would have asked for as a reasonable royalty. He was allowed to testify.
What does that mean? I mean, sufficient background in the industry so that he, I mean, obviously he has a view. Nobody's disputing that he probably has a view as to what he thought it was worth. But what does it mean, background in the industry? He wasn't qualified as an expert, correct?
Correct.
Are you contending that he should have been qualified as an expert? Is that the dispute here with the district court judge, that you should have qualified as an expert?
No, we should have. What the dispute was, all parties, the judge agreed that he should be able to testify as to the background knowledge. He sold the devices, he made the devices, he knows what they cost, he knows what his profit was. But he wasn't allowed to offer the last little piece, which was, and because of that, I would have asked for a royalty in the, you know, I'll pick a number, in the 50, he made $200 profit on the last few, he made $50 profit on the first one. So he said, I would have expected a reasonable royalty less than my profits of $200, but more than my original profits of $50, so somewhere between $50 and $100. He wasn't allowed to make that final statement. And that combined with the judge's instructions, where the judge said the only testimony you heard from as to what a reasonable royalty is came from the expert. And we cited that in our brief.
You didn't have an expert.
We did not have an expert. The defendants had an expert. But because Mr. Rashi was not allowed to make that final step, make that final statement, that because of all these factors, I think, not from an expert standpoint, but from a person in the business, if I was sitting down at that hypothetical negotiation, I would have asked for, based upon these factors. The jury was led to believe that the only testimony on royalties was 1%. And that combined with the instruction that you can give...
Well, the only expert testimony on that was 1%.
That's correct. But the way the instructions were given, and we cited them there, along with the instruction of nominal damages. If the plaintiff hasn't told you what his damages are, you can give him nominal damages if he believes incorrect instruction and error of law. That combined with the instruction that where the judge overemphasized expert testimony is only one of the 12 Georgia-Pacific factors. It's not the only factor. The judge overemphasized that, saying this is the royalty you can pick. There isn't any other.
What percentage... if he had been allowed to testify, what percent, or what's the difference in terms of what he would have said?
The 1% worked out to, I believe, depends if there's a range of sales, about $17 per $2,500 system, which was discounted because of certain factors. Ground ratio, about $17. He would have testified between $50 and $100, what he would have expected.
So that's like 5%
times. About 5 or 6%. Well, we're not talking a significant difference. He wasn't looking for 50% or 100% royalty. It would have been, he wouldn't have testified as a percentage because he's making a different product. It would have been a portion of his profits, like a third or a quarter of what his profit would have been on sales.
Mr. Zito, did you object to the jury instruction?
Yes, we did. But the part I cited actually was not in the jury instructions. These were part of the term ad lib instructions from the judge.
Oh, those are not part of the jury instructions.
No, he gave...
The nominal damage language was prior to, right?
Well, that was part of the jury. Part of the charge to the jury was the nominal damages, but it was not in the agreed jury instructions. It was added in by the judge while he was charging the jury.
While he was charging the jury, prior to. The formal jury instructions did not contain the nominal damage language.
The formal jury instructions that were agreed upon did not contain that. But he said, I'm now charging the jury. I believe it was part of his prefatory charge. He said nominal. But during the charge, the other portions we cite in our brief, or during, in the middle, interposed into the middle of the jury charges, but were not a part of the agreed jury charges.
But they didn't award them.
Because of the way the jury charges were given, we can't determine whether or not the jury granted 1%, thinking that was nominal. You see what I'm saying? We think 1% was too low. What was a reasonable royalty? And the jury could have understood that even if you think the royalty should be higher, you award nominal royalties, and the lowest number they heard was 1%, so that may have, can't delve into the jury's mind, that may have in the jury's mind been what nominal meant.
But going back to the issue of nominal damages, that was essentially in the preamble to the jury instruction.
Yes,
not part of the formal jury instructions that were given to the jury.
But the jury doesn't make a distinction between, they didn't have written or formal instructions, they don't make a distinction between what is a preamble and what's an instruction. And what the judge said, I'm now going to charge you. After that statement, he made a nominal damages instruction, and then went on to read mostly what we had agreed to and add some other interpretation to it. So I think it was part of the formal charge to the jury.
Thank you, Mr. Zito. You're well into your rebuttal time, but we'll add 1 minute to this. We'll have 5 full minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Briggs?
Thank you, Your Honors. Please, the court, my name is Alan Briggs, and with me is Peter LeVan. Mr. LeVan and I tried the case together. Let me address first the jurisdictional issue. We believe this court is without subject matter jurisdiction. And that is the very first point we discussed in our brief. We filed a motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And procedurally, let me just address how that came about.
Well, if I could just direct you, we've got your brief and your motion. I just don't want the time to run out because I do have some questions on the willfulness issue. So perhaps if you have time later, you can address whatever you want and recording satisfaction. But let me ask you about the willfulness.
Sure.
Why wasn't there enough evidence to go to the jury in light of the fact that there had been evidence, there was no legal opinion here, there were questions raised during cross-examination with respect to the confidence of the non-legal opinion? Why wasn't that sufficient to go to the jury?
There wasn't any evidence with regard to willfulness, in all due respect, Your Honor. If this is a case where the testimony that came in the plaintiff's case showed a company that did an incredibly outstanding job of responding properly and appropriately. There was no testimony, at least all plaintiff called was essentially, they called Mr. Warkola, the director of engineering. He testified. There's 145 pages of his testimony. There isn't any one suggestion of incompetency there. There isn't any challenge of incompetence in any respect whatsoever. I invite your attention to that testimony. I'm sure you probably read it, but I would invite you to read that. What you hear is a company who didn't know anything about the patent. Once they learned about the patent, they then had their director of engineering sit down and carefully review the patent and compare it to what their product was. He then had three other engineers separately and independently sit down and review the patent and review their product and go over everything to determine independently whether or not there was infringement. They then got together and went over it carefully, and they concluded they did not infringe. They didn't have any question about that. They went through and identified in their answers to interrogatories 8 separate reasons why they didn't infringe. They made it very clear why they didn't infringe. There wasn't any doubt they didn't infringe, in all due respect, and it was covered carefully, completely, thoroughly by the company. While appellant's counsel suggests that there was some challenge to the competency, I invite you to read that testimony. There wasn't the slightest suggestion.
Well, what about the specifics he alluded to 5 minutes ago, which is that the testimony was that they were in a position to assess claim construction?
Pure fiction. There is no relationship to the record, Your Honor. Pure fiction. just as many of the statements in the brief, they had no support in the record. I invite you to read Mr. Orcola's testimony. It was as thorough, as competent as a company could do. They had four, and then the president of the company, engineer, sit down and separately review it and say, we don't infringe. And while appellant's counsel said, we went through all eight reasons that he disavowed those, he didn't. Mr. Orcola got on the stand and said, that's why we didn't infringe. I reviewed it then, I review it now. We don't infringe. But what that company did was, then the lawsuit was filed at the end of December, but it wasn't served. They sent a letter, and the letter's an exhibit, and they said, let's sit down and talk about it. They talked about it. They couldn't resolve it. The lawsuit was served at the end of April, and then Judge Giles immediately held a pretrial conference and ordered an immediate mediation. The parties asked for it. They then indicated the record. The parties then met in early August, just 3 or 4 months after the lawsuit's filed, and they couldn't resolve it at that mediation, and the company said, we don't infringe. Nonetheless, we'll take it off. We don't want any question whatsoever as to our good faith in the industry. They removed it. They took all of the product off the market. They changed their marketing brochures. They moved heaven and earth, even though they didn't infringe.
Okay, I think you've answered the question.
Thank you.
About the expert testimony here and the failure to allow testimony. What about the fact that there were other Georgia-specific factors like the expert? Why shouldn't this individual have been allowed to give his view about how much he would charge and explain what the basis of the claim was?
Well, first, as to the other Georgia-specific factors, at least what I looked at, the 15 factors, and with the last one being the hypothetical, the 14th being the expert. Mr. Aracy went through, and Appellant's counsel went through each of those factors about which he had any knowledge, and he offered evidence as to the profits, as to the history. All of the Georgia-specific factors where Mr. Aracy had any knowledge whatsoever, he offered that. That was in evidence. There was no question. All of those Georgia-Pacific factors were met. The only other one was was number 14 in Georgia-Pacific, which says expert testimony with regard to the hypothetical expert testimony as to a reasonable royalty. Mr. Aracy said, I don't know anything about licensing. I have no opinion with regard to a reasonable royalty. I've never had any negotiations. I've never established a figure. I don't know anything about that. The law is absolutely clear that he didn't have any foundation to give an opinion. Rule 701 and 702 of the Federal Rules of Evidence make it clear that he's not qualified to give expert testimony or opinion testimony of a layman. Either one. The rules make it clear you can't follow what's under real expert testimony under 701 through 702. Didn't have any basis whatsoever to get in to say what he says, what counsel said, and what he said at trial. What he liked to do is have Mr. Aracy get on the stand and say, here's what I would have liked to have gotten. That just isn't relevant. That's just pure speculation as to after the fact wish lists. The hypothetical negotiation, which is factor 15 in Georgia-Pacific, calls for what a prudent man would do, the objective prudent person, and it's prudent licensor and prudent licensee. All of the evidence goes to that.
Are you saying that the inventor is not a prudent person when he takes the stand asking about a royalty fee for his invention?
Mr. Reyes is a very prudent person, very prudent welder, a very prudent man, a very nice man. No question about that. And he honestly said, I don't know anything about royalties. I just don't know anything about that. That's what he said. He's a prudent, honest man, and that's what he said.
Well, that's what the judge seems to have provided upon. He admitted he didn't know anything about the royalties matters.
Well, he was a prudent, honest man. He said, I don't know anything about that. And in the normal court, we don't let people testify about things they don't know something about. And let me address
Mr. Briggs, going back to the issue of willfulness.
Yes, sir.
is it fair, is it proper for an engineer to look at a patent and make a determination as to validity of the patent? Not on infringement, but on validity.
I don't know. I suppose it depends on that particular engineer. For the most part, I think validity is a legal question. It's what I think about. But there wasn't any testimony as to validity. Mr. Wakola specifically said that. He wasn't looking at that.
He testified. He limited his testimony to infringement.
Yes, sir, he did.
Sometimes I think that engineers probably have a better understanding of infringement of claims than lawyers do.
Could well be. He said specifically that it had nothing to do with
validity. But aside from that, they're much more practical and willing to take up issues that lawyers seem to legalize. But do you think that an internal determination made by an engineer on the issue of infringement and validity is sufficient to overcome a willful charge of infringement?
Well, that's a factual question that the trier of fact has to listen to and make a judgment under Rule 50 as to that evidence that he's heard. Is that sufficient evidence that if that were to go to the jury based upon that evidence, would that support a verdict? That's what Rule 50 is all about. So you've got to sort of listen to the testimony. I mean, I could hypothesize an engineer who conceivably, the facts could be such to say, well, that should go and others that shouldn't. That's why I think you look at it as I think the law is, it's an abuse of discretion standard as to did Judge Giles properly apply the test. He read it, he heard it, he listened to it, he listened to the witnesses, and it was so clear that what that company did was something that was as good as a company response could be. To even suggest it's willful, there's no relationship to reality in all due respect. Could there be an engineer where you'd see it differently? Conceivable. That wasn't this case. Let me address the jurisdiction. It is an important point. This, and my belief is zero here with regard to reversal. But separate and apart from that, this court has no jurisdiction.
Was there a meeting of the minds that the payment
absolutely. The meeting of the minds occurred as a matter of law. The law is absolutely clear that where there is a judgment and there is a check tendered in accordance with that judgment for the full payment of it, and either the check or an accompanying letter says this is in full satisfaction of that judgment. Acceptance of that as a matter of law in Maryland, where this was accepted, and in every state in this country pursuant to.
But full satisfaction of the final amount says nothing about the satisfaction of any additional amounts that might be in dispute. Clearly, those additional amounts beyond that amount are subject of a dispute, correct? So, why can't full satisfaction of the final judgment be satisfaction of the amount that you've been found, but why would that necessarily get rid of, eliminate the additional amounts that are disputed?
Because there was a disputed amount at that point in time. It's the position of Meyer Product. It didn't know anything. The finding of infringement was improper. Meyer had the right to appeal the judgment. The judgment was on May 24th. The notice of appeal is on June 2. At that point in time, Meyer says to itself, I have the right to appeal, but if I can resolve this for the $21,000 and be done with it and be done paying lawyers and dealing with this, I'd rather do it. And I'll give up my right to appeal if I can resolve it. That's a disputed amount. They think money's owed to them. We think it's not. We send a check. If you accept that check, it's made clear, this is to resolve that judgment. And that check says, or an accompanying letter says, this is in full satisfaction. As a matter of law, it's over. And that is the section 311 of the Uniform Commercial Code. It's the law in Maryland. It's the law in every state in the United States that that is, as a matter of law, accord and satisfaction. The Houghton case, which is the Supreme Court 1960 case, says payment of that judgment in and of itself doesn't mean that that is satisfaction, but you have to look at what there is. And what there, in that particular case, in the Supreme Court case, there was an accompanying release that said it just, it relates only to release of some specific liens. And each party was appealing. Each party had a dispute. They wanted it reversed. To the contrary here, Meyer gave up its right to appeal. This was a disputed amount. They tender a check and say, take this check to resolve a disputed claim. The law says that's it, it's over. As a matter of law, we believe this court has no jurisdiction.
So we should dismiss it for lack of jurisdiction?
Yes, sir. We believe it's a matter of law.
What about some of the cases that have fallen off and saying, in essence, if the judgment that you received is inadequate and you're challenging the amount of that judgment?
You have to look at each one. That isn't what they say, in all due respect. What they say is, again, that standing alone isn't enough. You have to look at what the facts are and to see if there's any issue. If you look at the facts here, and that is, if you look at the facts where there is a check that is tendered. First, there is the right to appeal at the time. On the 2nd of June, Meyer has the right to appeal. At that point in time, he tenders a check and a letter and says, this is it. And those are the right exact words out of the statute. On that, as a matter of law, you look at it and say, it's over because there's a basic fundamental rule of settlement of a disputed claim by acceptance of money at that point in time resolves it. You can look at other cases and where there are specific facts that make it clear it wasn't intended to resolve it. Houghton's one, there are others that do, others don't. We point out the law that said it becomes moot when this is in fact tendered, this is accepted, and the judgment is fully satisfied. We believe as a matter of law, there is no jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. Briggs.
Thank you.
Mr. Zito, you have 5 minutes. If you need them.
I might need 4. As far as the issue of jurisdiction and satisfaction, whether or not there was a resolution, I think we showed the facts in our reply brief that there was obviously no meeting of mind, no resolution. And as a matter of fact, defendant's counsel didn't even think there was a resolution. Why did he provide pages for the appendix? Why did he accept our brief? Why did he ask for
it? But if the reference was to final judgment, then it was only final judgment when the issues are finally and conclusively disposed of, correct?
The case law is completely in our favor. And neither side is disputing that they owe.
The case law is split. There are cases that support their position, cases that support your position. It's not totally one-sided. But why don't you proceed? That's why you think it's not a final judgment and why you have no jurisdiction. Why we do have jurisdiction?
Because there's no evidence. All the evidence surrounding the circumstances show that there was no meeting of minds, there was no resolution. Secondly, the check wasn't tendered or received until after the time it expired for them to file an appeal. They didn't file an appeal. There's no dispute over the $18,000 that they paid.
Well, let me ask you just what is the issue here? I mean, they sent a letter with these terms and then the check. Are you saying that just by cashing the check, you don't agree to the terms of the letter? Or are you saying that even agreeing to the terms of the letter, you didn't forego jurisdiction with respect to this appeal?
Letters in the record. There aren't any terms in the letter. It says the court orders to pay you $18,000 plus cost and interest. We're giving you a check because of what the court ordered. It doesn't say in full satisfaction of the dispute, in full resolution of the issues. It's not what it says. It says we're paying you the money the court orders to pay you. It doesn't say accept this in satisfaction or court.
What does it say?
What
May I tender the letter?
The letter is attached. Yeah, I think the letter is actually attached to your brief.
May I tender the letter? It is attached.
Actually, I guess the letter technically is not in the record. It was attached to the motion. It was properly filed by, I believe, second.
But there's no, you haven't disputed this is the action. This is the letter.
No, we don't dispute it.
Okay, so full satisfaction of the final judgment. That's the term of the first letter.
Right, but only the final judgment, not of the issues that remain in dispute or on appeal. Not full satisfaction of the appeal, full satisfaction of the issues between the parties. We understood that letter. I received the letter. Understood the letter to be, we're on appeal. We know what the issues are on appeal. We're not appealing whether or not we owe you 1%. We agree we owe 1%. And here is our check for that 1%. We're proceeding forward with the other issues, only of the final judgment, not of the issues that are appealed.
But you're appealing the final judgment.
Yes.
You're not appealing the final judgment. Then what are you appealing?
This letter was preceded by correspondence back and forth between counsel, where the defendants tendered an offer of more than twice that amount, which was specifically refused in writing. No, we are not settling the disputed issues.
Well, what's your answer to Judge Barrett's question? Appealing the final judgment.
No, we're not appealing the $18,000 part of the final judgment. We've all agreed that they owe at least that much money. We're appealing whether or not they owe more money, and that's what the case law supports. That if there's an additional amount in dispute, you can accept the amount that's not disputed and continue to argue about the additional amount. There's, the case law supports that. And that's what we took the letter as being. We're not, since we're not disputing the 1%, the dispute is over something else, we're paying you the 1%.
Yep, the additional factor here is the language is full, in full satisfaction. I mean, it's not just we're paying you what the final judgment required. Here it is. It's this amount.
Correct. It's not full satisfaction of the dispute between the parties. It's full satisfaction of.
The language we clear in this technical language, legal technical language, is to get full satisfaction of the final judgment means. Full final judgment satisfaction is, in fact, a satisfaction with final judgment.
If you take.
Which you have appealed from. But the appeal then may be eliminated by the fact that you accepted payment of full final judgment.
You can't look at four technical words in a letter and ignore all the surrounding correspondence between the parties, between the counsel. It was clear, beyond any doubt, that what was meant by that letter, to both our side and the other side. If you realize, the day after that letter, there was no communication that said, now that this appeal has been resolved, let's stop spending money on briefs. Now this appeal has been resolved, why are we sending? The activities before the letter and after that letter don't support defense counsel's now interpretation of the letter. We had exchanged settlement offers back and forth for more than twice that amount, which were absolutely specifically refused. To then say, somehow plaintiff changed their mind and took half as much money without any agreement, without any meeting, without any resolution. And then after doing that, we continued to file briefs, spend money on the appendix. After that letter, we got joint appendix pages, and it's in our response. Joint appendix pages from defendant. Why did he send us joint appendix pages if he thought that the issue was resolved?
Well, did he ever come back after this and say, well, in light of the fact that you've reached this agreement, we want our money back, and this is a resolution?
No, he did not. Never asked for his money back because we continued to appeal. As a matter of fact, before he filed his brief, he called up and asked for, or sent me an email, and asked for a two-week extension, which we gave him, purportedly because he was needed more time to work on his brief, responding to our brief. He never said at that time, oh, and by the way, this case is resolved, so we don't even need to go forward. He never had that belief. He never expressed that belief before. over after that letter.
Mr. Zito, thank you very much. Case is submitted.
I hope to address...
You've already used up all of your time.
Your Honor, may I briefly respond?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned this afternoon at 2:00 p.m.